Okay.
So,
okay.
Okay. Let's go and get started. Wow. Something's due.
Yeah, the train was out.
The train was out?
Yeah.
Huh.
I had to come here with the cab. I was gonna want people
just for you.
Yeah, why is the train out?
I don't know. Maintenance problems, I guess.
Anyway. So there's three things I want to talk about. It's time for me to start talking about databases. I want to talk about databases because I want to start doing MongoDB and tutorial because I want databases on the last assignment. But before that, there are these two things, which if we don't get to databases today, that's okay. If I spend the whole class on databases, that's okay too. So we'll see how it goes. What I want to talk about was first just something that's come up with respect to the assignment. And this actually relates to the second one, which is when you have your HTML document, in your HTML document you have various tags, you know, whether you're P's, your, you know, LIs, you know, whatever, headers. You got these tags, you have the closed tags, you have the contents, and as part of these tags, you can specify properties. You can specify an ID tag, you can specify a class associated with it. Now, what are those for? So the idea is that this is being put into a tree. The document is parsed being put into a tree. These are identifiers that are put into the DOM to allow other things to access the DOM. Now, what are those labels used by? They're used by two things, CSS and JavaScript. And you know, in your CSS file, you'll have things that can say, that will have, if it starts with a dot, that's the class. It starts with the pound, it's the ID. If it just doesn't have anything, it's a tag. And all CSS is specifying properties of things in your HTML document. Now, of course, when we say CSS, we're talking about cascading style sheets. So this is the style sheets portion, as you specify what it is. But what's the cascading part? It's inheritance. That's all it is. When we're talking about cascading style sheets, we're talking about inheritance. It means that you can, in particular with the classes, you can specify subclasses so that you don't have to repeat the same styling for every element. You can say, oh, here's a basic class for this one element, and then these other elements will be exactly the same style, except they'll override certain things. It's inheritance. It's object orientation. It's what you've been doing, learning about, you know, your whole time here. So it should all be really familiar. But just that's what you're seeing here. And then in your JavaScript, you use jQuery or use the native DOM elements to access these, to modify them. Because this is how you refer to the DOM elements to change them. So that's the relationship these two. So JavaScript, you'll have dollar ID, and then you do stuff with it. So just same identifiers referring to here, because remember we've got a data structure here. This is one way of basically adding to the data structure, CSS, and this is programmatic control of the data structure with JavaScript. about this more. I'm hoping this is pretty clear. The easiest way, I mean, all this sort of stuff is just, you know, the JavaScript, the CSS and HTML I haven't talked about much, but again, that was what Code Academy's for. I can talk about specific questions if you have them. It's fine, but I don't want to go through it because if I just lecture about it, it's crazy boring. Questions? Okay. So moving on. So the next thing I want to talk with, so I'm not done grading, but I am grading. I've made progress on grading, and I'm not happy with grading. In particular, the last question's a bit of a disaster on the midterm, which is talking about the control flow. Now, I don't know about, I may end up curving the test or something like that, but normally the way things work with my classes is I can do things to add marks to the end or something if there's consistently people are lower or something, but you've got all these tutorial marks which will generally boost things up and stuff. So I'm not too worried about the fact that a lot of your midterms are low. If your midterm, you know, if you fail the midterm even or something, don't panic unless it means that you really didn't understand big chunks of the material. If you didn't understand it, okay, but for the last question, I can't decide how much of it is you didn't understand the question or you didn't understand the material or misinterpreted the question. The reason why I talk about this is I realize you all don't know about what control flow is, which is kind of one of these concepts I go, I don't know what control flow is. So, does anyone want to tell, when I talk about the control flow of a program, what am I talking about? Yeah, I'm thinking of the control structures. Really, I'm thinking about where does the program counter go, roughly speaking. How does the code, but I'm thinking of it as a higher level abstraction of it. Have you ever heard of a control flow graph?
Yeah.
Where was that covered?
Engineering,
okay. Have you discussed control flow graphs? Hey, this is. So this is an idea from compilers that's normally taught. It's not a very complex idea, but it is worth talking about. So a control flow graph is a graph representation of program structure. And this is the kind of representation that's very useful for compiling programs, because once you have it in a graph structure, then you can look for graph patterns, and then you can use that for optimization purposes. And also then, once you have the graph data structure, if you want to translate it to another language, you just assign code snippets to the nodes, and then you just walk the graph, and you've got your code. So, the way you typically notate this is you have specific operations. And then with these sort of things, like this might be an assignment statement or something. This might be, but then maybe this is a conditional. So like, let's say I equals 5. So you can say I, let's say j greater than I. So this is the, you know, the true branch, the false branch. Then you maybe do something here. So you can see that this is just following the structure of your code. Like here, if the condition is true, you've got some stuff here. If the condition was false, you have some stuff here. What if you say you're calling a function, calling some other code? Well, you might have a node here that says, okay, now you're going to something else. So you can think that every time you do any sort of operation in your program, it can be represented as a node, and any sort of change in control flow can be represented by changes in the graph, by branching the graph, by the decisions or whatever you're doing. So why it's interesting to talk about the control flow graph is because I want you to have I don't necessarily need you to draw a control flow graph per se of your program, because if you do it in a very detailed way, it's a big pain. But you should have an intuitive notion of what this graph basically looks like for any program that you write. in the sense of you should know how things move. Now, this is particularly important in a class like this because the graph is weird for web applications. Why is it weird?
Because the graph is basically built with the assumption of a standard functional programming language, which is not how web languages work. The paradigm they work in is different, so the flow is different enough to make the graph much more confusing.
So all you said was true. I agree with it, but why is it weird? And I'd say the key thing that is weird about it,
there is no main function, and we're always like maybe this line jump to another file, and then the next line of the second file jumps back to the first file and the third file.
Right. Well, so there's two things. That's part of it. So one is that no main. In fact, what it is really is event-driven. So you don't actually have a graph that kind of covers your entire execution. At least you don't control the entire graph. What you do is you fill in the blank. There is a particular condition, an event, and you write the code for what happens in that context. You don't decide when those things happen. Some of them are controlled by the user, when those things happen, user interface events. Some of them are controlled by the network, some of them are controlled by timers or whatever. You don't control the overall flow of your program. You just create little bits of it, and they get attached to this overall graph that you don't necessarily know what the exact structure is. That's really what event-driven programming is. So, the other thing is, it's not just client-server, it's distributed. In particular, your control flow logically goes between your browser and one or more servers. Because in effect, when you are doing things like the getJSON command or something, that is a remote procedure call. Have you learned about remote procedure calls? So, a remote procedure call, RPC. Remote procedure calls, the idea behind a remote procedure call is when I'm in a networked environment, I want to call procedures, functions. You know, a function is just a procedure that returns a value. But I want to call procedures that are not on my local machine. I want to call procedures that are on a remote machine. And I want them to execute, and then I want them potentially to return a value to me as if they were on my machine locally. So the idea is I just write my own program the way I would normally, but sometimes when I make a call, I'm actually doing operations on the network. From a security point of view, I hate RPCs as a programming model for network programming because it confuses what is inside your program with what is outside your program. Because you can never be sure that you're actually getting valid data from an RPC because it might have gotten spoofed or something unless you use various security mechanisms and they all have limitations and stuff. But so, as a side note, RPCs have fundamental security problems. But from a programming standpoint, they have a lot of benefits, but they also have complications because what happens, when you call a function in a normal program, do you expect it to return? Yes. In an RPC, you call a function, it's calling another computer, maybe that computer's down. Maybe there was a network error or something. Maybe there was just some sort of problem. What do? The semantics are fundamentally different. But this means when I say, when I say remote procedure call, I'm saying I'm calling a function foo. Foo is not running locally on my machine. It's calling something else. Goes to network. So this means my control flow graph, if I were to draw it out, does it incorporates behavior on multiple computers. And what's really weird about that incorporating the things from multiple computers is not just that the control flow can fail, but also if you're thinking about data structures, it gets really messy because, of course, they don't share memory. You have a data structure locally, you call it with that data structure, it's not there on the remote side. So what do you have to do? You have to copy it. You have to send it over the network. So always when you do RPC, it's always call by value. Versus call, so call, either things are call by value or call by reference. It's not call by reference in RPC, it's always call by value. You can try faking call by reference, but it's always call by value. Do you know call by reference versus call by value? Does that have any meaning to you? So, because yes, so good. You know, call by reference, your call by value is you pass a number along. Call by reference, you set a pointer or something and you're referring to the data structure. In JavaScript normally, is the semantics of JavaScript function calls call by reference or call by value? In JavaScript, when you call a JavaScript function, are the arguments call by reference or are they call by value?
They're obviously called by reference, and if they're used, they're called by value.
Right. Basically, it's call by reference. It just so happens that primitive types, when you call by reference them, it's an immutable object, so you just pass it around. It's a mutable thing, so you just pass it around. So it's fundamentally call by reference. So that means that when you pass around, but if you do an RPC, it's call by value. So you'll see there's this bit of a semantic gap between what you're doing with standard JavaScript and when you go out on the network. Things to keep in mind when you're doing stuff. What I tend to encourage, so, let me step back a second. In your lookings around on web programming, you might have seen these phrases, SOAP and REST. How many of you have seen SOAP? Most of you have not seen SOAP. Have you all heard REST? Yeah, not that many. So when you see these acronyms, SOAP stands for, I think, Simple Object Access Program. I forget what these things stand for. They're now more, they technically are acronyms, but you just refer to this. SOAP was really an effort, and it's still around, it's not dead, but it's really an effort to do RPC properly over the web. The idea is that when you make a function call, there should be machinery behind the scenes that handles all the network details so that your code doesn't see any of it, but underneath it does all this translation. What does it have to do? I have to take whatever data structures you have, pass them along to the other side, bring them back, make all this machine work so it seems like you're calling functions that are local on your machine. The problem with SOAP is that as an RPC mechanism, it was first of all based on XML. XML is a generalization of HTML. It's got your angle bracket tags, but the difference is you can define whatever tags you want. You have schemas that define what the tags mean. XML is very verbose. So that's one knock against it. And the SOAP protocols, even though XML is verbose, the SOAP protocols based on XML are ridiculously verbose. So it turns out using SOAP is very, underneath the hood, it's very complex machinery. And the other thing is it tries to hide something that is dangerous to hide, which is the fact that you're calling things over the network. What's REST? REST is GET, POST, plus, there's two others. Delete, and receive, I think, or something. I forget the other ones. There are some other ones that aren't part of the HTTP spec, but there are other protocol things. You want to do... I can explain this in a... I don't want to explain REST right now. But the idea of REST is, rather than have a very complex machinery for doing interactions with the server in an RPC style, let's simplify it. We'll do everything that you'd want to do in an RPC-type system just using gets and posts, and make the actions simple enough so that, in fact, you can kind of do it more in a web browser. You don't have to do all this complex manipulation of XML to call your web application. You just generate these gets and posts. Just talk standard HTTP, and you're doing remote procedure call-like things. So it's a standard way of using standard web protocols in a way that allows you to do, you know, do flow of control across the network. Of course, when you do RESTful type things, they don't look exactly like remote procedure calls. They look a little bit different. But in fact, all the stuff you've been doing in Node is very RESTful because the API is designed around, you know, you say app.get, app.post. And then you have, you know, a function handling stuff. This is very RESTful-like. So, to a first approximation, you're already doing this. Not exactly, but you're on the way. You're not doing SOAP stuff. And in fact, I'd say it's not... there's not really a point in doing this nowadays. I mean, there might be legacy protocols and things for doing it, but it doesn't provide you any additional functionality, and it provides lots of complexity. So if someone says, let's do web programming, oh, let's use SOAP, run away screaming. Or insist they pay you a lot more. One of the two. So why I'm talking about this, so what I wanted in that last question was for you to tell me the flow of control of the web application with it going between the client and server. I wanted you to say, okay, the client gets this. Then it sends this HTTP get command to the server. The server, in response to that get, runs this function, which then does this. Then it sends, you know, in response to this, in these conditions, it sends this then back to the client. I wanted that back and forth and back and forth because that is the key pattern of the flow of control of a web application. And because it goes back and forth and back and forth, you can't write either side assuming it knows what the state of the other side is. Because in fact it will vary. And in fact for a web server, it will actually be dealing with many web clients which will be in different states. And it has to coordinate all of those. And that, in fact, is actually why it's better to do things in an event-driven type style of execution, because then you don't have to worry about the interleaving. When you're programming your game and you're saying, oh, I've got one session, do you worry that there might be 50 other sessions running at the same time when you write that code? No, you just have to concern yourself about this session. Other parts of Node deal with the fact that there might be 50 other sessions. You don't care. Just like when you're running your web application in the browser, You don't care that the browser may have other tabs open to who knows how many web pages. It doesn't matter. It's not your concern. The system takes care of it for you. You just have one window. So when you think of control flow of a web application or anything with event-driven programming, you think of it in more behavioral terms, stimulus, response. What is a stimulus? What is a response? What comes in? What goes out? Do you know the relative ordering of these stimulus response things? No. If you have to, if you want an ordering, you have to enforce it manually. And in general, you want to enforce as little ordering as possible. Now, is this like your desktop GUI programming? It has some similarities to it. Depends on what sort of things you order. Yes?
When event-driven and interrupt-driven would probably be pretty similar. Real-time systems, multitasking. Computers don't really multitask. They just work on small chunks of a series of things, and they're just fast enough it looks like they're doing multiple things at a time.
Yes and no. It used to be the case that was definitely the case.
Unless you had multiple processors, right?
Yeah, now we've got everything has multiple processors. And if you're going to do things on a GPU, you've got hundreds of units doing things in parallel. So it used to be computers were very, very serial. Now we just try to close our eyes really hard and pretend they're serial when they're in fact massively parallel. Even, it's actually worse than that. So you might have noticed that modern processors don't. When we say a processor is a gigahertz, what does that mean?
A clock speed.
It's a clock speed. You'll notice that processor. So in principle, it used to be you have a higher clock speed, you have a faster processor. Now they hit something called the thermal wall. They couldn't make the processor run any faster without melting the chip. So that's why processors have not gone much above a gigahertz. I mean, 1, 2, 3 maybe, but really that's about it. And they're not going to be getting much faster because otherwise it just gets too hot. And there's certain fundamental physics reasons for that. But chips keep getting faster. Mostly.
Because of the architecture, huh?
Right, but when we say architecture, what do you mean?
That's the physical arrangement of transistors.
You probably heard this,
but theoretically.
But what you say?
Well, they make the chips smaller, so if you have less distance that you need to send, a bit across the processor.
So, propagation delay does go down, and that does speed it up a bit. That's not a big win. That's a bit of a win. It's more of a temperature win.
Then we get into the optimization, prefetching, pipelining,
okay.
Range prediction.
Which you're getting at, which is
memory.
what all the things of prefetching, it's all examples of fake parallelism. That's what's happening. Is in fact your main processor, if you're talking about a superscalar out of order execution processor, what it really means is that processor is so impatient with your code that it just keeps executing code that it doesn't even know you're ever going to run.
Yeah.
You take an if branch. It doesn't go to the if branch and say, oh, well, what it does, sometimes it will say, okay, this is an if branch. In the past, you've always gone to the true branch of this, so I'm just going to start executing the true part before I even know whether the branch is true or false. I'll just execute that. Or if the process is really aggressive, it will execute both the true and the false branch in parallel. And then later on, once it knows the value of whether it was true or false, it will throw away the results of one of those branches. That's speculative execution. It's running ahead and thinks it knows what your program's going to do, and it executes that branch. That's what branch prediction is I think it's going to be true. So let me just execute as if it's true, and then later on it says, oh, it was true. I made it right. Oh, no, it wasn't true. It was false. I throw away all those results. So as you might imagine, lots of guesses wrong makes the program behave. It makes it much slower than it would be otherwise.
But even with multiple processors, on the grand scheme of things, we're still using the same data bus.
Right? So they still have to wait for each other to send that information.
No. There's, I mean, now it's all point-to-point interconnects and all kinds of things to
there's
make it up.
There's not one main.
Well,
but bus architectures have basically been superseded by more point-to-point ones when you get to more than two processors.
Of course. Then you run
GPI
into things like memory latency and cache misses, which are big slowdowns.
Yeah. So when we say cache misses and latency, what we're then saying is, that's a separate thing of saying your processor is so much faster than your main memory. So, how do you deal with that?
It takes entire milliseconds to access something on a physical hard disk.
Yeah.
That's millions of seconds.
So what we're talking about there is something called the memory hierarchy. It's a big factor. I could start giving my whole architectural lesson here. But the reason why I wanted to mention this is that when you think of your processor as executing one instruction after another, it doesn't do that at all.
Unless it's running the clock really high.
Nope.
Multi-core processors, if they're running maximum clock speed, they're only running one core, because if they try to run multiples, they will melt.
Right, but the one core that is running really fast is executing things in parallel.
It will also cause a lot of glitches when you have high clock speed.
Mm-hmm. What? Mm-hmm.
It will cause a lot of glitches when you have a high clock speed and the CPU can't compensate for the high clock speed.
Well, yeah, that's a separate engineering issue. I'm talking about from a software perspective, which you're looking for the performance of it. It's always executing, and it executes, if you've got a sequence of five instructions, it's executing all five instructions at the same time. In different stages. That's what pipelining is. Branch prediction is I'm executing these two possible branches of program at the same time and seeing which one's right. I mean, anytime it's trying to predict what your program's going to do before it actually does it and executes a program as if it was, and if it makes a mistake, it undoes it. So it provides the illusion that it did one thing after the other after the other. So the engineers did this for a long time and then they finally gave up. They said, we could throw transistors at the problem to make branch prediction all the things better, and they got it as good as they could do, and they said, we can't do any more. That's why everything went multi-core about 6-7 years ago, I guess, mid-2000s when things really started becoming everything multi-core, because they basically said, we can't do anything more with these transistors.
Now there's the idea of quantum.
That's a whole other thing. You're not going to see that for a while. And if you do, Lord help you in programming it.
The only other thing is physically changing the substrate of the transistors.
Yeah.
Instead of using something instead of silicon.
Yeah.
I've heard that one of the things they're looking at is boron doped synthetic diamonds.
Oh, they're looking at lots of stuff.
The only thing is, when are you going to get it cheap enough that you can use diamonds in your processor?
So all that diversion was really saying, when we talk about control flow, you don't actually understand the low-level control flow of your program, and don't even try. The folks who made the chips on which your programs run don't know exactly how your programs run, because it's doing all kinds of crazy, adaptive, speculative things under the hood that the only way they know how well it works is they benchmark it. And they compare it, and they hand-tune little parameters to their prediction engines to see real workloads to make it faster. You don't know what's going on at the low level. Don't pretend like you do. So enjoy the abstraction. Enjoy your box. And just try to understand that, really. You have to understand how that fits together and what your role is in each little component and how they connect. And relating to that, we get to databases. Actually, we get to our pause because we're right at the middle. So I will stop here before talking about databases.
Okay,
well, who wants to ask your question?
Ask. So I was wondering about the jQuery file.
Okay, the jQuery file.
You know, like...
Oh, by the way, you all know the assignment's due on Monday, right? Monday at midnight. So if you want to ask me questions in class on Monday, it's fine too.
Can you like?
But the tutorial on Friday will be on databases, so. Yeah.
Can you like change like just one of them into jQuery and like stop it out? Like just like, change one of the DOM into a jQuery and it still works.
Is this supposed to be working?
Or
you have to change the entire thing and then it would work.
So you have to look at the dependency of each line.
Okay.
Because most, you don't necessarily have to make many changes. So a lot of those lines are only, the reason why it's created a variable is just to add an event listener.
Mm-hmm.
If you change just one of them, you just have to change the corresponding listener to use jQuery. You change one of those. But you have to look at each reference to that variable.
Okay.
Now, there aren't that many. Most of them are setting up event listeners, so you change it at the top, you change it at the bottom. There's a few of them that are exceptions. Now, what is your friend for doing this sort of changes to the code?
Google.
Yeah. Well, Google helps, but how, when you're watching the program execution, the easiest thing is just to look at console.log. If you look at the console log for JavaScript in the browser notices when the code executes improperly. And it will tell you, I don't know, this thing had some error on this line or something. And it will actually show you. So look at the console.
For dependencies? No,
when you change things to jQuery, you've changed the type of the object. If anything tries to access a method or something that doesn't exist, the browser's going to notice. It's going to say, that doesn't exist. I can't call that. And it'll generate an error, which normally your web browser just ignores because web browsers have to deal with all kinds of really bad code.
Because I changed some and then there weren't any errors, but then the game wouldn't pop up.
Did you look at the console?
Yeah, the console.
Okay, so again, of course, some of the errors JavaScript will generate won't do that, but do it incrementally.
Okay.
Don't make a bunch of changes and expect it to work. You should be able to change things like a little bit, and then change the core thing, and then it should work.
And you said for the touch stuff, we don't need to change that.
You can just ignore the touch
stuff.
Although you might have to just take it out.
Because I looked it up and then.
All the touch stuff will turn into jQuery stuff really trivially. It's just that you can't test it.
I changed the first line and my game wouldn't pop up. And there was no errors. I changed one line.
Well, yeah, because you broke it.
And it was like, oh god.
Now you can't just. When you change that one line, you have to see where was that code used elsewhere.
Okay. So I changed the info button.
Yeah.
Then I have to change.
So if you really get stuck on this stuff, I mean, do the other parts of the exercise.
Yeah.
You know?
You can leave this for the end, right?
Yeah.
But the jQuery part.
No, I'm saying is that do as much of the assignment as you can. Don't, if you get, this is general academic strategy, you know, if you get stuck on one part, you can join the other parts. I mean, you could do the entire thing and not use any jQuery and just lose points in that one part and get points for everything else.
So it only loses that one part.
Right. As long as it works.
Yeah.
So yes.
Yeah, so like if you're adding more like for the previous like the next questions, like I think 4 or 5, like you have to add some like document query selectors and like document.get all by ID. So if you don't have jQuery implemented.
Yeah, some of the other ones you can.
So if you turns out you didn't do the jQuery part, you'll have to do the rest of the parts using standard DOM access methods. So sure. My hope was you'd do it all in jQuery, but if you can't figure out jQuery, you do it in.
But those questions explicitly state for us to use jQuery. That's what I mean. Would we lose marks extra?
How are they worded? Does it say to use jQuery? It just says implement this.
This is implement this.
Yeah.
Ajax.
It just says implement. Now, I think I said the Ajax one. Like,
yeah, the Ajax.
Listen, if you do the Ajax stuff without jQuery, more power to you. I mean, you're just setting yourself up for pain. Yeah. I mean, you might. What is probably easier is you can mix jQuery and non-jQuery stuff. You don't convert the old stuff, and you just insert new things that you jQuery just for that little part. That is entirely possible too. You don't necessarily have to convert the entire thing, but yeah. Ajax without jQuery is just. I mean, you can do it. You can look up the templates, but it's not. I mean, it's one line in jQuery. It's not one line otherwise.
So if we only change some things in jQuery and other things just because it works that way for us, do you still get at least part marks for
You'll get if you use some jQuery, you'll get some part marks. Yeah, you'll get.
Will the client let the browser understand the two languages, the mix between the two languages, jQuery and DOM?
What do you think?
Yes.
Yeah. It's not two languages.
It's just a library.
Okay.
It's just a library. That one's a wrapper around the other stuff. That's what's, yeah.
Okay. Yes? Yes. Yeah, the Canvas stuff don't change. I mean, if you want to do the Canvas stuff, see, it turns out jQuery doesn't have explicit support for Canvas. There are plugins for jQuery that do have Canvas support, but the ones I saw have very different models, so you'd have to rewrite much of the code. That's not worth doing. Hmm? Yeah. Yeah. You'll get full marks if you change the top of the top of the program and the bottom of the program. That's the part that I really want you to do. There's other things you could change. The two that you change the top and bottom and it still works.
Because I changed it.
You just change it. You don't get credit for breaking the code. You know, whatever code you turn. Basic rule of a programming class, don't submit code that is broken. One thing it does is it ticks off your TA. Because your TA now is having to go through and trying to debug your program implicitly to try to give you partial marks. It's hard work. Do not tick off your TA. Basic rule. Now, what you can do is you can say, I tried this. Like you can say, this is my working code. Here is my draft of the code, which I tried to get working and it didn't work. If you want to turn in some supplemental thing, I made partial progress, but this is what works, okay, but always turn in working code. That's, I mean, because really, what's the worth of a program if it doesn't run? Great work of literature? No. So, good? I'm going to now talk about databases, the part of the web application I have neglected the entire term, except for the very beginning. So, as of now, you should at least see the basic issue with having something else as a persistent store, because all your data structures in your web application have all been in-memory data structures, so that when you restart the web application, you lose all your state. So that's bad. Now, you could say, well, why don't I just write it to a file? Hey, it's all just JavaScript, JSON, I could encode it as JSON, write it to a file, and then just read it back in. And I will tell you, you can do that. But almost always you don't want to do that. And instead you want to use a database. Now the question is, why? Why do you want this piece? What I say is, don't tell me what a database does. Tell me about what would just saving it to a file on the server, why is that not such a good idea?
Everyone can access files. They can just read the files. The database will have like security stuff.
I have file permissions. I can lock down a file. Databases are built on top of files. No.
Queries.
Okay, look, queries, you're kind of getting at it, but this and then get it.
jQuery.
Multiple users. Each one would need their own file, or they'd have to have some way of identifying which part of the one master file you're using. And having individual files for several users stack up overhead relatively quickly. Databases are generally a more efficient storage structure.
Okay, having multiple files, sort of.
For handling multiple users. And making it easier to make sure you only get
those are all, I wouldn't disagree with them, but I wouldn't say those are the compelling things.
Well, databases have a lot more I.O., I guess, efficiency. They're really structured for doing...
Databases are a lot more complicated. They're running on the same operating system, actually, they can add more overhead.
But you can support things like RAID.
So you're talking about a high-end database server. Certainly, like, if you have a big Oracle cluster that, you know, right across, you know, petabytes of data or something. Yeah, certainly, yeah, but that you could have run your web application on that, too.
Is it, like, modulates the data, right? So you can build the database, and then you don't have to worry about, like, adding, doing all your add calls, and you don't have to write that in.
Sort of.
It's much easier to query a database than it is to parse through a file.
Query versus parsing. Associative arrays are pretty easy to get access to. Right? Associative array, put a string in, get the value.
I guess the database is more locked down than.
The keyword that you should always think of, which is kind of when you're talking with multiple users, it's partially there, but it's concurrency. Concurrency and durability. So let me give you a scenario. So if you have things in a file, what do you store in the file? So let's say you have some in-memory data structure. When do you write it to disk? You write it when your web server shuts down? Your web server never ends. It's supposed to run all the time. It doesn't quit. So when do you save?
Whenever it changes.
Hmm?
Whenever it changes.
Okay, so you're constantly writing this file. Now, you've got this, you know, you could say, okay, let's say I have each user's file, and I could, you know, I could have every user has their own file, and I could just write that file, but now I've got to load in that whole user's state, edit it, and then save the whole thing. So I have this very, maybe I just make change one small value, but I have to save the entire file. That's not good. It's like you got a word processing document and you edit one character and you have to save the whole word processing. It's like multi-megabytes. That's not very efficient. So what databases, so one thing that databases are all about in this durability is saying that I want to keep the state on disk at all times. But I want to keep it in some sort of persistent store at all times so that it has the least likelihood of being corrupted. I don't want to have my entire state in memory and then have some other version on disk. I want it to be basically the same thing. I want to be able to update what's on disk incrementally, very quickly. I want to be able to say, okay, I've got all this data on this user. I'm going to change one value. And I want to be able to change that one value and not corrupt everything else. So that's a key thing. But then the other thing is the concurrency issue. Is I want to do those little small incremental updates from lots of different sources. I want to be changing these data structures left, right, and center. I mean, databases are fundamentally on-disk data structures. That's all they are, which allow for concurrent updates of different parts of the data structure at the same time without corrupting the entire thing. Indexing and all this other stuff is in general, and it's something you can do with databases, but you can do it without a database very fast too. You can do indexes of flat files without a problem. It's just a general way of accelerating things. Databases have good support for indices because you do a lot of queries. But the whole reason why you bother with a database is because you want to support data durability and data, you know, when I say durability, I mean it's going to not be deleted, integrity, and concurrent access. If you want all those properties, you need a database. And if you don't have a database, you're going to implement one in practice in some way or the other. So then the question is, what sort of database do you want? And there's a little... So there's this thing you'll see about SQL and no SQL. Type databases. Now, when you say no SQL, what they're really saying is it's not this, but this is actually a... There's a whole lot of different things that fit in this. Databases with lots of different kinds of properties. Some that are very simple, some that are very complex. We're going to focus on something called MongoDB in this class. MongoDB can be thought of as a document store. Other kinds of no SQL type databases are key value stores. There's maybe some other types of things, but we're concerned with this document store. So think of this logically, it's almost like you have Microsoft, it's like you have Word documents or something. Like every, you're storing a collection of Word documents. They have weird structure in them. Who knows what it is? But what this allows you to do is to incrementally update each Word document, little parts of it, without corrupting the rest of the Word document. And the also concurrent access to them. But they're independent documents. But when we talk about SQL, what they're typically talking about is something known as relational databases. Now, we're not going to talk a lot about what a relational data about using relational databases in this class. We have 3005, which you will learn all about relational databases. But what I would like you to understand is why relational databases are pretty cool and kind of complicated. And also understand why they often are way overkill for most database for most web applications. So what the SQL stuff comes out of is an old tradition in online transaction processing, which is saying that who developed this stuff? Really, you're talking about the mainframe guys. And what the mainframe guys wanted, it was they wanted large data stores that were incrementally updated. What sort of data did they store in them?
Transactions?
Wait, well, transactions is a computer science abstraction.
Oh, business transactions.
Business operations. Things like, the classic things they would put in these sort of things are like payroll, accounts receivable. You know, so that. Now, you do kind of like general databases for those sort of things. The business functions is, you know, there are some reasons why you might want to use some of this, but it's not too hard. The thing that really pushed technology are things like airline reservations. Airline reservations were one of the kind of the early, really big applications of relational database technology. And so first off, why do you think that an airline reservation might be kind of a tricky problem to solve?
Because you have limited space, and then people like reserve, you want to make sure that it's very accurate.
Okay, that's part of it. Yes.
Connected routes, like stopovers.
So connected routes. So first off, it's global, right? You know, you've got you know airline reservations. You're talking about getting things from all over the world.
I think the problem is that you can't allow two people to get the same time.
Right. So the interlocking things are, so it's global, so anyone can be making requests of this system in real time. The fundamental data structures you have are seat reservations. And so, first off, you have to be able to have everyone, you have one shared thing is that each
plane that's going to fly, each flight, is a whole collection of records. It's in each seat, who is sitting in each seat for this particular flight. And then associated with that, you have, did they pay? So it's not so much the case now, but it used to be you could more reserve a seat and then pay later. And these reservations could come in from anywhere in the world at different times, and then the payments would come in. So you would actually have people, okay, they make a reservation 2 weeks in advance of the flight, then a week later, they cancel the reservation. Or they don't cancel it, they go right up to the time, the reservation's still there, but they just don't show up for the flight. And then you have, and they manage that, okay, well, this person canceled the flight, so I have to refund their money. Or now they're using it as a credit, and then I'm paying for another seat. So there's this complex relationship between payments, individuals, and flights. And they're all being updated in real time from folks around the world. And you really don't want to have a situation where you sell the same seat to multiple people, because you can't have two people in one seat. And you really don't, and the airlines really get upset if you give someone a seat reservation and don't get money from them. So by today's standards and what we can do on today's computers, this isn't that complicated, relatively speaking. We do now do much more complicated things in terms of distributed systems. But you're talking the 60s, 1960s, this was complex stuff. So systems like Sabre really pioneered this. So in making these kind of systems, you have this problem of you have multiple updates you want to do to different data structures. And the semantics only make sense if all the updates go through or if none of them go through. You get invalid semantics, like if you make a reserve a seat but don't get a payment. Or you make a payment and you don't reserve a seat. Those are both very bad things. But this is a big distributed system. There's lots of ways for things to fail. Sometimes one will happen, not the other. Like, you might try saying, oh, they paid for the seat. And then you try grabbing their seat reservation, but someone just reserved it from underneath you. So now the seat is no longer available. So you better refund the money. So when we talk about transaction processing, transactions, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about making changes to multiple data structures, multiple durable data structures, in such a way that we always, that the changes are always consistent, meaning that if we make changes to one and we don't successfully make changes to the others to update everything, we have to undo all of our changes as a unit. All should happen, or none should happen. So that means you have atomic commits, which really means you just keep track of things. So that all the commits, when you make something a transaction, you're making something that is indivisible. All of it happens, or none of it happens. So you open a transaction, you start making changes. But the changes are only committed to the database if the transaction is completed. If the transaction is not completed, everything is undone. This is what SQL gives you. SQL-backed databases, when we say relational database, it means they have multiple tables, multiple data structures that are all related together. You have the seats, you have the payments, you have the individuals. These are all separate things that are linked together. Those are the relationships between them. And the transactions can span these multiple tables so that it all forms one so you have individual transactions so that updates, like if you do a debit of this individual, you have a record that they paid and their payment record is synchronized with their seat reservation record. as you might imagine, coding something to do this really well so that you never lose any data, so you always have these things commit right or uncommit, is a bit of a tricky coding exercise, and it has certain performance implications. Because you have to maintain the synchronization across systems. You can't ever allow the system to sell a seat that someone else has already bought. So you have to have this global synchronized state that, is that seat available? Yes or no? I need that question answered definitely one way or the other. I can't say, well, I think it hasn't been sold, but this guy might have sold it and I have to check with them. I'll tell you later that it is. That's called eventual consistency and stuff, and that, you know, that's not good for these kind of systems. Now you say, well, how is that hard to do? Well, if your database exists on one computer, yeah, it's not hard. If your database exists on 1,000 computers, this is hard. NoSQL has really come up because it's realized that when you try scaling this sort of synchronous transactions across large distributed systems, it has huge performance penalties. And because it has huge performance, and most of the time, you don't need those guarantees. Like, for example, you're in a web application. The only information you're keeping is records for individual users. Like, for example, think of something like Gmail. Gmail stores things for each user's email. I don't really care about synchronizing the mailboxes between them. There's no relationship between different people's mailboxes. They're separate things. So all I might care about is concurrent access to the same user's mailbox. But it's for one person. You don't expect them to be accessing their mailbox on 5 machines at once and deleting email and reading email at the same time. I don't know if you ever tried using Gmail on multiple computers at the same time. If you've ever done it, you'll notice that updates you make to one computer don't immediately appear in the other computers. They'll eventually appear, but sometimes they'll be a little consistent, some of these will pop up backwards. It's eventual consistency. That's not as good as what you get with a true relational database, because in fact Gmail is not backed by a full relational database. They don't enforce that kind of thing. They're allowed to sell seats to multiple people at once, because most of the time it's just going to be one person. Your email, one person, they don't care. You might imagine if you don't have to synchronize things, you can scale more easily. You don't have, the Gmail servers don't have to all check to see, I've got a Nils mail here. Is anyone else accessing a Nils mail? Can I make any changes? If I make any changes here, I'll tell you about it and stuff. You don't have to synchronize those changes. So when we talk about NoSQL, what we're really talking about is saying, this is all transactions, making everything, I can let that slide. I don't need to have a consistent view of the world everywhere at the same time. If your application demands a consistent view of the world at the same time everywhere, use a relational database. If you're willing to deal with some amount of consistency, or you're not going to have transactions, you're not going to be updating multiple parts and make sure everything happens at once, or you're willing to implement that yourself, you can go with one of the other ones, and in general, have more flexibility. Like, for example, in a classic SQL database, you have a rigid schema, which means, basically, it's the difference between Java and JavaScript. In Java, you define your classes, and when you have a class, that's the structure of the class. In SQL, you define the structure of a table, and it has certain fields, and that's what you've got. You're not updating that at runtime. If you need any new ones, you better have built it in first hand, otherwise you're just not going to use it. With MongoDB, you've got a document, it can have whatever. Basically, the documents are JSON objects to a first approximation. You want to add fields? Go ahead. You don't want to fill in one? Sure. You don't have to follow a rigid schema. You don't have to follow a standard pattern of what properties any given document will have. Now, does that make potentially kind of chaotic? Maybe, but for an application, that might be exactly right. Maybe you can enforce your own schema using another layer, which in fact you can do. But the system doesn't know and doesn't care that is consistent. Questions?
No, know, I thought you could create and delete tables on the fly. I just do them.
You can, but you don't.
No, well, you'd have to change the code associated.
Yeah, I'm saying is, in general, so SQL management, you can add tables and you can drop them, but it's not something you do operationally. They're not; these are not ephemeral data structures. These are very heavyweight things. When you create a table, it's normally considered to be a table that will live for a good while. If you're going to be starting to delete tables or change structuring, basically that's when you bring in your database administrator and they start doing things and optimizing it and making sure data hasn't been lost and stuff, and it's just like, oh my God, you want to change how your SQL database is structured? I have to back up your entire database before I do that, because I might trash all your data, so I better be careful. It's like, to a first approximation, it's almost like changing the way your disk is formatted when you start messing with the function of tables. I mean, you can reformat disks, you can change the thing, but...
You also have to, like, rebuild your indexes every so often, too.
Well, that's just for performance. I mean, any system that does indices has to rebuild them periodically simply because your data gets updated and the index gets out of date. But it's that's just all new. The main thing is, yeah, the structure of a relational database, it can be changed, but it's not something that changes at runtime. It's something that it's more of a development decision, and it's something that has significant costs. With something like MongoDB, your application program wants to dynamically add properties to your document and stuff like that. Doesn't care. Go for it. Have user-defined properties. Doesn't matter. It doesn't care about the structure. Now, can you do transactions in something like MongoDB? In principle, you could. If you're trying to do it, you're using the wrong tool. Which means don't try to synchronize the state between multiple documents. They're independent. Treat them as they're independent. If you need some business logic to connect them, okay, but don't expect it to be completely consistent all the time. You might get, especially if you start having a distributed database, there might be some inconsistencies. It's up to your code to make sure it propagates the information.
Well, it's sort of like off topic from all that you were about to say. So I go first.
I don't know what I was about to say, so.
Could you show us like some of the file structure of MongoDB, like sort of like what was actually in some of the files?
So what you're talking about is how is MongoDB implemented. So we'll talk more about how to use MongoDB. But the first thing to understand about any database is you don't know how it works.
I meant more of like what type of files you would store.
You don't, no, what you do is, basically, to a first approximation of MongoDB, you give it a JSON object. You say, here's my JSON object. The main difference between standard JSON and what MongoDB does is you can specify types, and it will restrict the types of certain properties. So you can say, this is always going to be a number. In a classic, you know, JSON object, it can turn out to be anything. Well, no, now it's going to be a number. But you can change that on the fly, too. But that's all you're doing is just storing JSON objects and getting JSON objects out. Where is it storing it? So in your database, is it storing it in a file? Is it storing it in some other thing? You don't know. You don't care. You don't look there. It's an abstraction layer. It's doing magic behind the scenes. Follow the API. If you're curious, you can find out how it works and stuff, but almost always when you lift the covers from a database, you go, oh my God, what are you doing there? Because it's typically pretty complicated. And you go, when we start playing with MongoDB, you can bring up the admin panel for MongoDB, and it tells you all kinds of statistics about how the database works and stuff like that. You look at those numbers, and if you can make sense of most of those numbers, you're doing pretty well, because I can't make sense of a lot of those numbers. I mean, I kind of know what a lot of them are. But they're saying a lot of statistics on how it does things. Because, I mean, if you think about how you would implement something like this that's going to be that dynamic and it's going to be fast, it has to do a lot of funky things in terms of how it allocates storage. It how it puts things and how it indexes them and stuff like that. It's these are non-trivial systems. So, when you look to see how they're, you learn a lot about how memory, you know, on-disk memory allocation is done and how things are organized and how you build indices efficiently and stuff like that. But if you're just using it, you don't care. But this is also one reason, typically, that when you move a database from one system to another, you can't always just copy the files. Because a lot of times, if you just copy the files from one system to another, it won't work quite right. One reason for that is that, in fact, the file may say it's 1 gigabyte in size, and actually it's 100 megs of storage on disk, because, in fact, the rest of it is not really there. But if you copy it, you get a 1 gigabyte file on the other side. This is because you can put holes in files. This is a Unix thing. Some database systems use that. Others don't. So, I can cover more stuff, but I just kind of want to get to this sort of intuitive view of why you bother with databases making sense, or are pieces feeling kind of unclear? Because I feel like you can't understand any tool unless you understand its role in the ecosystem. Like, why did we bother implementing databases in here? It's because we realized we needed concurrent access to a data store. We want that data store to be durable. And one way that web applications scale is by you take this and you replicate this. You replicate this thing, you have lots of computation happening. But now, how do you keep those replicas talking to each other? So you separate the replicas. They are all ephemeral. They don't store data, you know, permanently at all. They all then talk to a backend database. It will scale in different ways. And anything that you have to write to it that has to be durable, that it will take care of it. Only require coordination where you have to have it. That's the real beauty of web applications, is they allow things to be uncoordinated, be parallel for lots of times because they don't have to be all synchronized. That was a real advance that happened with web systems, why they became so much bigger than any previous systems, is that web applications were based on technologies that allowed for parallelism without coordination. Remember, HTTP? Stateless. There is all the notion of a session, all the notion of the server remembering who you are, it's all built on top of the basic protocol. If I want to just have part of my web application just serve up files that are static, I can just replicate it, and it will work fine. It's only when I have program logic that I start having to think about coordination. And then I can just make my program logic be replicated, except where it has to communicate. And all the communication in a web application between the different things happens typically in the database, which is something that is optimized for lots of different systems accessing the same data store and modifying it in a safe way. And we are out of time. Last figure.
Yeah, that's been about the document object model.
Okay, well, we're out of time, so you can meet next customer. Ask me something. Thanks.